we're recording.
Now we're recording.
Switch off your mic and see what happens. There she goes.
Okay,
now
you
turn
just...
turn it off.
Well, I'll take off from Carnation Lumber Company in about 1952, some of the other corporate members of Carnation Lumber Company, they were getting older and kind of wanted to retire and step out of the mill business. And of course, I was younger and I wanted to go right ahead on her. I was full steam and young. And so we located a fellow by the name of Axel Erickson, that he was one of our local people here and a very successful logger and a good logger. And a man of the last generation of loggers and a tough breed. And he bought out their interest, and he and I became partners in Carnation Lumber Company, and he took care of the logging, and I run the sawmill. And then about 1954, it became advantageous for both of us to liquidate our interest and liquidate the mill and the timber. And Axel Erickson had most of his interests and holdings by this time. He had changed his interest from the Salmonberry country over on the Wilson River and down to Northern California. And he was substantially interested in that country down there around Smith River and Garberville and Happy Camp and in that area. So it was advantageous for me tax-wise to liquidate my interest there. So what we did was we found a buyer for the sawmill, and he didn't particularly care for the timber, so that was just fine. So we kept the timber and sold the mill. And then we logged together. I went to the woods then, and that was my first exposure, real exposure to logging. Of course, I've been all around it here in the country all my life, and can well remember back to the locomotive railroading days and the days of the steam donkey. And so I went to the woods then with my partner Axel, and so he's going to teach me how to log. And the first job I had was shoveling mud out of the rollers on the cat, and then choker setting and on up the line. As a matter of fact, I think Axel and I, we rigged the last tree for high lead logging in the Forest Grove area, any place up and down here for quite some time, for quite some distance. And I remember the last tree we rigged, we limbed a pretty fair sized tree, an old growth tree, and topped her at 140 feet and hung the rigging block and main block and all the rest of the blocks right on down the line, including the top guys and the buckle guys and all the rest of the rigging that goes with it. And I remember we had a VUX 140 for a yarding machine with a Cummings 200 engine on it. And then, of course, we had a gas loading pot. After we logged together for about 2 years, Axel wanted to go on down to California entirely, so then it come to splitting up our assets, which we owned half and half. And so between the two of us and just a real short order, we picked out what I would need to log with and what I wouldn't need to log with. And between the two of us, we split the thing up and sold a little of the machinery. And I bought all of the timber and the timberland that I could afford to buy, and started out from there. And Axel was a good partner. He's a very shrewd man, and I learned a lot from him about business. And of course, it's just like anything else that goes you through life. You learn the good things, and you learn what not to do. And I started out logging from there, and I took a cutting contract. One of the things was a cutting contract with the city of McMinnville and their watershed. And that turned out to be extremely successful for me. But after some several years on that cutting contract, I began to realize that there was so many contract cutters, loggers running around the country, and at the end of the Tillamook burn, the salvage of the Tillamook burn was going to come to an end, and that there was going to have to be, this thing was going to have to boil down to a few successful contract cutters, and the rest of them were going to have to go by the way because there just wasn't room for that many loggers around the country. And I thought to myself that that if a fellow liked this business and he wanted to stay in it, that he'd better start buying some timber and timberland, and he'd better have something like that to secure his future. And so I started out in the last half of the 50s of buying all the timber and the timberland that I could afford to buy along the way.
How expensive was the land?
Well,
when you started buying it?
Well, the land, you could buy it for $25-$30 an acre, and of course it about the going rate on second growth stumpage at that time, or second growth trees, was about $25-$30 a thousand per thousand board feet. And of course through the 50s and on through the 60s and into the 70s, why, it's done nothing but appreciate now to where second growth is now stumpage is worth probably in the neighborhood right now someplace between about $150 a thousand. So it's had quite an appreciation. And then, of course, the logging of the old growth, finishing the old growth forest, of harvesting the old growth forest, why, then it's boiled down to the second growth forest. And of course, forestry has come heavily into the picture since the 50s. In the 50s, why, we were talking about the concept of tree farming. And to a lot of loggers, why, tree farming, that's just like reducing them down to being a farmer out on the flatlands and shit on your shoes and everything else, and that doesn't appeal to a logger at all. And the name tree farming didn't appeal to me either. I thought that was kind of degrading. And time has proven that tree farming is the proper name for it. And tree farming in its infancy, which really started out probably in about the middle 40s, is when we first were starting to practice tree farming, and that was a very young age for tree farming. And on into the 50s, it picked up steam, and of course by the last of the 50s, why, I began to have more and more ownership of land. And I was buying cutover land and forests, but mainly cutover land seemed to be the best buys, because most people didn't realize that when land was cut over, as it was then, that a lot of the scattered trees, that there was still a log and show there, even though they thought it was cut over and there was no value left on the land.
Tree farming?
In the beginning of tree farming, the concept of tree farming, in about the mid-40s, I think probably one of the first really tree farmers at that time was a fellow by the name of Melvin Bud Howell. We called him Bud all the time. He lives over at Gales Creek. And I think probably, Lloyd, you'll probably be wanting to interview and talk to him sometime here during your course of your work here. And I think he's about one of the first in the country here. And I think probably about the second to practice tree farming to any extensive amount at all. And I remember in 1956, when I bought what we call the Lee Place, just north of Cherry Grove, about a mile and a half, and it stretches on back for about 2.5 miles back into the mountains.
This is an original
homestead. And when I first bought the place, why, as you come up from Cherry Grove and come on to the tree farm, why, it was all fields all the way up through the place. And those fields were homestead fields and donation land claims. And what I bought was not only a private purchase of land, but the private purchase of land was comprised mainly of three old ownerships or donation land claims. There was the Lee land claim, and then some people by the name of Stompenbeck, and the foundation of their house still stands down here in the brush. As a matter of fact, in falling some timber this last year, we cut into some of their old square nails with our power saws. And then the third donation land claim was the old Davis land claim. And those people took their land claims up here in the foothills of the Coast Range, and of course this land was in timber, and it was cleared by the people and during that time, cleared land was actually worth more than timbered land, because we had so much timber land in that country at that time, and so few people that timber was a drug on the market. And anyhow, they cleared the land, but the land was really, its best use was for trees. And they tried to farm here, and they did for a few years, when you could take a sack of flour or sack of wheat to town and come back with a sack of flour on Saturday afternoon. And you could take a half a hog or a hog down and have it smoked, cured, or they did it themselves. Most of them had their own curing smokehouses. And you could get along that way, but during these days of high yield agriculture, you can't live like that anymore. If you could, probably those people or their heirs would probably still be here. But when I first bought the place, I realized what I thought was the situation. And after completing the purchase place, I had professional foresters come in, take soil samples and other calculations to determine what the best use of the land was. And after they made up timber type maps of what timber was on the place, and compiled their soil samples and so forth, of course it come out its best use was timber. So then we started planting trees, and I think about the first five years we planted approximately 2 million plus trees. And, of course, we didn't know so much about planting trees in those days, and a lot of these fields were full of grass, which is the toughest kind of competition for these young trees, and it's just hard to get them started unless you destroy the grass first, but we didn't understand a lot of those things. And, matter of fact, right off to our right here, that's a 10,000 tree planting that took a 9,999 tree flop. There's only one tree growing out of the first 10,000. So then when I plowed up all those fields and had a local farmer down here come up here and then disc it all down and planted it again, and they all grew. So we were kind of poking and jabbing and learning during those years, the last of the 50s. And of course, forestry and tree farming has progressed and come a long ways. We not only have learned better methods and better techniques of planting these trees and getting them to grow, and that's a problem too, because that little seedling, which is about 2 years old when it comes out of the nursery, is most of them, and when you plant them, they've got to make it on their own. They suffer the shock of transplanting, and they suffer the shock of trying to get their roots squared around in the ground and get going, and they have to suffer the summer's heat. And usually when we first used to plant, we figured that about by and large the average survival at the end of the first summer in those early days of tree planting was probably around between 50% and 60%, and of course the rest were all casualties. But now with better planting, we haven't planted with tree hoes for some time. We auger plant altogether right now. We take one of our power saws with a gear head on it, and it's got about a 4-inch auger, and we bore the hole, and it assures a more correct plant each time. We've been auger planting now for the last for about the last 6 years now. And of course, I'm speaking the last 6 years. That means from 1978 on back. And we're now getting on South Hill slopes, which is some of your toughest slopes, because it gets the hottest part of the sun and the hottest exposure to the sun, and your ground temperature is the hottest there. We're getting now around 80% survival the first year, and we maybe take probably a 5% casualty the second year, and and maybe a 1 or 1.5% casualty the third year, and the rest of them generally go. And we're having much better luck these days when also we've come into the nursery practices where we grow the seedlings from germination. Why, they do a lot better job now. They understand a lot better about keeping their beds clean and keeping disease out of their beds and rotating the soil in the nursery and fertilizing and the and probably several other things to grow a healthier seedling. And also we're paying more attention now. We pay strict attention now to the seed source. That is, whether it's low elevation, medium elevation, or high, and what county it come from, and such things, maybe several more. And of course, we've been tree planting now for the last last 22 years, and our oldest plantings now are getting up around 21 years old. And instead of a lot of vacant fields now of land which would be low production land as far as agriculture is concerned, why, we have a nice new young healthy forest coming back now. And after you plant the trees and get your forest to growing and coming back, why, proper forest management figures heavily from there on out, and your forest has to be managed from now on. We can no longer afford the luxury of sitting down and just watching our trees just grow as thick as we plant them, or too thick and crowding each other. We have to keep them spaced out and practice all of the good attributes of forest management. And this involves a lot of things which I'll touch on from time to time. Now, we had very little, not too much wild game and wildlife with all of these bare fields, but now that we have timber coming back, why, we're realizing and seeing much more an abundance of wildlife activity. The one thing that was which caused me great concern was during the years when insecticides and the use of chemicals first started coming in, and the common thought at that time was that, gee, this is the answer to everything. But it certainly wasn't, because the first thing we knew, we didn't have so many birds. I keep reflecting back on that book.
What's your name?
I reflect back on The Silent Spring with Rachel Carlson. Nobody believed it. She was called all kinds of things, but she was so right. But she was very visionary. They termed very visionary at that time, but she was exactly right. And I saw it happen up here, and it was alarming to go by day after day and not hardly see a bird for around 3 or 4 years. And so then we started realizing what was happening, it's too bad that mortal human beings have to be so much in error all the time and poke and jab and experiment, it seems like, but that's the way it is. And so then the federal government and other people started taking a real second look at the use of chemicals and insecticides. And when we did that, why, then we had more coyotes back in the country. The coyotes have always been termed some kind of a villain and a dirty bird, but up here in the mountains, why, that coyote may be of some concern, real concern to the sheep men and the cattle men, but up here in the mountains, why, the coyote is our best friend. He keeps the game and health, the herds healthy, keeps them in size. The hunters don't do a very good job at it, and most of them don't hardly know when to pull the trigger. And coyote is really quite an animal, and figures heavily in the scheme of wildlife. And now we have birds back again in abundance, and we have all kinds of birds. As a matter of fact, I know that this first week of March that spring and warm weather is just around the corner, because one of these red-headed double-breasted bed thrashers just showed up on the front porch here the other day, so I know the spring is just here. And we have deer now, which are back in the country. More now in numbers like they should be, and that is the number of deer per acre of graze and browse. And we have elk coming down now into the lower elevations, and I really believe that the forestry is probably one reason for it. But elk is a funny animal. He changes his habits, and he's a traveler, and he'll browse wherever the feed is and according to what the winter is. On a hard winter, why, he's clear down in on the farmers. And we have them come through here all the time. There, matter of fact, there's a group of quite a bunch of elk in close to here right now. And they've last seen here last week down on the Alex Scott property, now the Orient property, who are the heirs of Scott. And we have elk come by. I built a house just recently, a new home recently up here on my tree farm, and we have elk stand in the front yard and come through, and coyote come by. And here last year, we had one old mother coyote that was teaching her pups to hunt up and down the road, and they used to take their afternoon siesta right out in front of the house. It's nice to see those things. The deer in the wintertime, a lot of people who don't really understand the deer, they think that he's terribly tame because he stands around right up around the house and so forth and in the front yard. But this isn't the truth. This isn't the way it is. The deer is just a wild animal, and he's just as wild as in the wintertime as he is in the summertime. But the deer knows that the browse is thin in the wintertime, and he must conserve his strength to make it through the winter, and he's got a hard pull, and so they don't move any more than they just have to. It's a matter of conservation of energy and strength, so he doesn't get any tamer really at one time of the year as he does the other. And of course, in tree farming, why, we have there are hazards besides just natural casualty of the trees, such as the in the young plantings. We not only have the weather that the tree has got to suffer through the first few years in order to get his roots down in the ground and get growing, but the deer do extensive damage to young tree plantings. In the wintertime, when the browse is thin and the deer is weak, he's no different than any of the rest of us. He wants to fill up his middle three times a day just like any of the rest of us. And so he comes along, you plant a nice young tree, gee, it's doing fine, and the next day you come back and the thing is 8 quarter into the ground, and the deer come along and he'll take the growth buds, he'll nip the growth buds out of the top of the tree, and then the rabbits come along and they nip the growth buds on all the lower limbs or the lower laterals, and then the mouse, he's hungry, and he comes along and he strips the bark off of the tree right around the base of it, and between all three of them, mainly, why, there goes your tree. And that's why we love the coyote. He comes through and he keeps those things all in balance and generally keeps things in order. And that's why the coyote, we count him as our friend, and we ask the hunters when they come up from town in the fall to go hunting that please don't shoot any of the coyotes. He's our buddy up here. We have to have him. Now, in our new young seedling trees that we get from the nursery, and when we plant them out, nearly all of those trees are dipped in a deer repellent when we get them from the nursery. But that repellent, it does a good job, and it keeps the deer off of them for the first year, of course. But the second year, the repellent, of course, is gone, and its effects, and that's when we have the most trouble with the deer, is the second year of planting. And the deer really are murderous at times. and especially in the hard winter. Now, this last winter, which was fairly mild, and in the winter of 1976, which we had a mild winter, a very mild winter, it was just like spring all year. We had a very little deer damage, more a normal amount. But in the tough winters, why, then we have extensive deer damage, and we have lots of trouble with them. On the nursery trees that come out of the nursery, why, after the repellent wears off, why, of course, there's still the effects of the fertilizer inside of the tree system itself, and it has, it's proven fact by tests and experimentation that the deer will browse a nursery tree for its first several years sooner than he will a wild-grown forest tree, one that's naturally germinated. It used to be years ago that when we had our old-growth forests and our large volumes of old-growth forests used to be the old-timers thought that we were never going to run out of timber, but we found out that wasn't true. We soon began to harvest and take off all of our old-growth forests, and we had very little left. The only old-growth forest now that remain of any volume and size at all is owned by the federal government. And some minor amount is in the hands of private industry. And so now we're looking at the second-growth tree, and these young trees that we're planting, these are our future forests, and these are our healthiest and best trees. And we watch these trees more closely now. We watch their growth by measurements with various instruments, several of which are, one of which is the tree auger, which sometimes why we go through our own forest and take a tree auger and bore into the tree and extract a core sample from it about the size of a pencil. And then we can see lots of things. We can see the color of the wood and tell pretty much about what the internal health of the tree is. We can see the ring count and how fast that tree is growing. And then we have another instrument that we call a relescope that measures the height and the diameter of the tree. And we set up growth plots, fifth acre growth plots, and we try to set them up so that we get a comparison. Comparison plots. We'll set up a plot in an unmanaged part of the forest and make the measurements, and then over on another part of the forest right close by, which will have similar exposure. Roughly, that's the way it goes. In a thin forest, in a managed part of our forest, and this way we can tell exactly what we're doing in the way of growth. This all helps. Now, 2 years ago, why we aerial fertilized, and that's another aspect of growing a faster forest and growing faster wood fiber. And we have to do this with our young trees. Now, with the older trees, of course, they were probably running several hundred years old. And their growth cycle, a tree is something like a human being. You're born, and a tree is germinated. A human being grows up, and he gets to be a teenager, and he's growing fast in his early teens. And then along about 17 and 18 and 19, and there's some place why a human being begins to peak out. Well, a young tree is just the same way. A tree comes along, and for about the first 10 years, it shows practically no growth. And then all of a sudden, the growth curve starts up real steep, and that tree is in its maximum growth age. And it'll stay in that maximum growth age. Now, a tree reaches its, after it's about 10 years, roughly about 10 to 12 years old sometime in there, it's in its maximum growth cycle. And it'll remain in that maximum growth cycle. Now, I'm speaking relative to what we call a site class 3, which is nothing more than the ability of the ground to grow a tree, roughly. And and a site class 3 is probably about the average growth site, probably about the average site area throughout the Coast Range in northwestern Oregon here. Now, over close to the coast, of course, we get into site class one, which is the very best and the very highest site class, and that will grow the fastest timber, and it's over there in the rain belt and the fog belt. But mainly site three is the average site class, and that's what we're talking about. And second growth tree, or the young tree, will begin to taper off in its growth cycle probably around age 50 years old, sometime in there. But the growth curve begins to flatten off, but it's still gaining and still growing and probably will for probably several hundred years old. But there comes a place in there sometime when it's an optimum time to cut that tree. Now, there's many things that figure into the optimum time to cut a tree, and that's the flattening off, not only the flattening off of the growth cycle, which is for site class three runs someplace between, say, 60 and 70 years, and we plan our sustained yield on about a 60-year rotation, and that is a rotation means the final crop. Within the interim of that, we'll probably have one pre-commercial thinning and one or two, probably two, commercial thinnings before final rotation. The reason for those thinnings is to keep those trees more spaced out, more reasonable spacing, so that they got their roots are not intermingling, and which allows and lets in disease, root rot.
What's that?
Poor you, weir eye.
How do you spell that anyway? Do you have any idea? What that disease you just said.
Of course, you have to keep that.
Yeah, you've got a problem in that. Are you running now?
Are we recording now? So you got the problem of disease in these young trees, and in any forest, you have trouble with disease, not only with insects, but it's in the ground too.
Okay. Well, the batteries are running low, so maybe if we can just. In the event that it stops on us completely, maybe you can...
We have the problem of disease in these young trees, and in order to eliminate and hold down disease and keep a tree at its maximum good health, it requires these thinnings, a pre-com thinning, pre-commercial thinning, which the trees are generally so small that they have no commercial value, not at this time. And in commercial thinning, of course, that will occur at age maybe 25 and years old, and then perhaps again maybe at 40 or 45 years old. And that's to space them out more so that the crowns are spaced. We look at crown spacing and ground spacing ourselves. We look at both of them when we're thinning, and so do other tree farmers. And this is just all a part of the scheme of good tree farming. Now, after the two commercial, one or two commercial thinnings are performed, and we are, say, approaching the age of around 60 to 70 years old, then we're looking pretty hard at a final crop rotation. Now, there's some other economic aspects that figure into a 60 to 70 year rotation, and that's the cost of administration, and the cost of generally carrying a forest through from its from year zero to final harvest, such as taxes and all of the other carrying costs, sometimes I feel that. And others too feel strongly that our legislators here in the state do not really have their fingers on the pulse of forestry and really understand the economics of forestry and the economic impact of forests in Oregon in the long pull. They're looking only at the short-term tax dollar. In other words, they're tax dollar oriented and not forest oriented, nor tax dollar oriented for the long pull. And there's much struggle in the legislature about this, especially in the last 5 years, where we, since 1969, we've had a number of negative reports on timber supply and timber standing timber inventory, culminating here in the state of Oregon recently with the Buter Report, or Bulletin Number 19, called Timber for Oregon's Tomorrow. And this causes some serious concern, and there's much struggle now between in legislature and collecting tax dollars to, of course, to finance the cost of government. In the last this last year, we are hearing a lot now about protectionism. At first, it was just a little riffle, and now it's growing into kind of a wave, and this causes me concern too. At first, I had concern about the volume of export logs flowing out of this country without any seeming aggregate plan as to determine what is surplus and what our needs are going to be here. Now, with a wave of protectionism coming on, and more than it's developed into a wave and more than a riffle, I fear that protectionists, diehard protectionists, are going to will close the door of export logs, and I don't think we ought to do that. We ought to be very careful because this affects our national policy. If we close the door completely to the exporting of timber, then we've locked ourselves out of a world market, perhaps, and it'll be hard to regain that position. And but there certainly should be some plan, some policy by our federal government as to what is going to be surplus. We all know what happened in 1973 when our grain bins were oversold, and Russia bought a substantial amount of grain from us, and it oversold our grain bins, and the price of bread went up sky high. All you have to do is ask our housewife about that. And this was nothing more than a lack of policy on part of our federal government. And I fear that our timber might suffer the same. And timber is our number one economy here in the state of Oregon by over $1 billion a year in this year of 1978. Well, agriculture is our second largest economy, which is approximately 50 to 60% of that amount, of that dollar amount. And I think that we should be very careful with our resources and what we're doing. And timber is a 60-year crop, and sometimes it's very hard to impress people that this is not like a wheat crop or a barley crop or some agriculture crop. And timber is a 60-year crop and a 60-year cycle, and we should make sure that we harvest our timber for our own needs, construction. Why, you want to build a shelf in your garage, and other things like that. Our forests certainly have to be managed. We can no longer afford to let our forests grow wild and unmanaged, and have a waste of timber that is falling down from disease, overcrowding. It has to be farmed in a workmanship-like manner. I think there's one thing to mention that's very significant as far as the growing of a forest is concerned. In the early 30s, we had a disastrous forest fire known as the Tillamook Burn, which covered I don't think anybody really knows for sure exactly the acreage, but it falls someplace in the at a 250,000 acres or more of timber, prime timber that was devastated by fire. And it was very hard to control because at that time we didn't have the network of roads. We didn't know about firefighting, and we didn't have aerial suppression, and a lot of other things, some methods to, and trained firefighting crews. We didn't have those, and so the fire just kind of burned out of control until it started to rain and put it out. And then come the salvage of the Tillamook Burn, and then after the salvage, which ended in the early part of the 50s, realizing that we had
a lot of land which was doing nothing, which was producing nothing, adding nothing to the economy of the state and the nation. The people of Oregon decided, even in Depression times, to float bond issues to rehabilitate and replant the Tillamook Burn. And just in about the year 1973, then we changed the terminology of the devastated area from the Tillamook Burn, and the Tillamook Burn was rededicated. It was completely planted back, and we had a beautiful young green forest coming back all over the Tillamook Burn. It's just a sight to see. To get on a high mountain and look out over all the green power that's coming back to the country now. And in about 1973, we had a rededication of the Tillamook Burn, and we call it, it was renamed by Governor Tom McCall for our state here. It was called the Tillamook Forest. So now we have the Tillamook Forest. And at this time, we're just now beginning to reap the harvest of those efforts. And which went on for years and years, the tree planting crews and the trees, no one can imagine unless you're right out here in the industry and in the mountains and saw it yourself. The effort that was made to bring back a forest. And now we're seeing some of the harvest off of that forest, and it's added significant amounts of tax dollars back into our economy. For instance, just this year, now in 1978, just this year, there's been the largest amount of tax dollars coming from timber back to general fund, education, schools, highways, whatever, and all of the facets of government. We've had more tax dollars come back to the counties than ever before in the history of Oregon. And it's my thinking that this trend is going to continue for some time, and then it will, of course, gradually peak out. There's one thing that's upsetting about it. While state forests are coming back, even so, our timber supply at this time is forecast to diminish until the year 2000. And this is upsetting in itself. But it can, if our legislature and our state will wake up as to the and become more familiar and get their fingers on the pulse of forest management and what it takes and the length of time to grow a forest and what has to be done, I think that the impact of short timber inventory that it will be diminished by some significant amount. Goodness knows how much. No one really knows. But try we will.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. I think you've answered all of the questions that I have prepared for you, and I appreciate it very much.